Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
You're listening to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Welcome to Why I Believe. My name is Rick Starr. This is the second in a four-part series about the Mormon handcart historic sites in Wyoming. Today we'll hear more handcart pioneer stories from missionaries along the trail at the site and learn about the Sun family who owned the ranch where Martin's Cove is located. We're here at one of the stations at Martin's Cove, and we're here with the Turricks from Cedar City. How are you enjoying your mission so far?
We are. We love it up here. We do. We absolutely love it. It's a wonderful place to be. There's a spirit about it that's here that you can't find anywhere on earth.
Sister Turrick, you have a story about one of your ancestors who was part of the Martin Handcart Company. Do you want to share that with us?
I'd be glad to. Okay, her name is Mary Barton. She ended up marrying an Allen down in southern Utah, which is why I'm from where I am. Mary Barton was 14 from England. She came with her father and her stepmother and a couple of younger siblings. And her older siblings were quite angry with them for joining the church, and they stayed in England. And the story goes is that they kind of made fun of her and persecuted her for the rest of her life for joining the church and coming to America. But a quick story about when they came across the ocean. She was with the Martin Company on the ship Horizon. She was 14, and she went up to cook dinner for her family. She was in the cook room. It was very crowded, and everybody was trying to cook their dinner at the same time. And another gentleman was cooking some soup in a milk can, and he reached up and carried to get it out, to take it out, and somebody bumped him. It spilled down his hand and down her back. And she went running out of there, and she told her father, "You've got to get the elders to administer to me." And so they took her downstairs. They administered to her, and she was instantly better. So they went to the other man that had spilled it on his hand, and they asked him if he wanted a blessing, and he said no. And in her writings, when she was later on, she said that it took him at least 2 to 3 weeks for him to heal. So that was a cool story. It was fun because our grandchildren know that story, and it's fun to hear them tell about it. So I'm glad their parents are sharing the story and telling them. The other thing is, she, one night, we're not sure exactly where it was. We don't want to put up an exact place to that. She was in a tent with four other men, and all four of those men died. And we know that her father passed away sleeping next to her. She, in the middle of the night, she remembers the time because it was just as they had announced the change of guard at midnight, and she knew her father had passed away. He got sick right out of Iowa City. He had what they called dropsy. They said he hung on the back of the cart most of the way, and he ate berries and things with the animals. At one point in time, he fell down, and he wouldn't get up and get going, and she talks about one of the captains coming along and kicking him, telling him to quit being a wimp, that he needed to get up and get going, which I'm sure they had to do many, many times. They had to get angry with him to keep him going. She also told a story about, and we don't know whether this was in the Cove or possibly at Red Buttes in Bessemer Bend, where they camped, and she said the handcarts blew away. She said the handcarts were, it was blowing so hard that it was obviously tipping the handcarts over. But she said that she went to sleep one night, and they were so cold and frozen, and the next morning as they were coming around looking for the dead, saying, "This looks like another dead one." And apparently they came over, and one of the rescuers came over and touched her, got down and looked at her and touched her, was going to go pick her up, and she opened her eyes. And she talked about how it startled him, and he jumped back. And she woke up, I guess, at that time. But she couldn't get up. And it took her a few minutes to realize why in the world she could not get up. Her hair had frozen to the ground, and there was enough water underneath her that her hair had frozen. She said that they had to take an axe and chop her hair out and take her over by the fire to melt. She ended up making it. She went on to Salt Lake and went down to Parowan, down to southern Utah and Cedar City. Another fun story is my husband's great-great-grandfather was C.A. Huntington, who was one of the rescuers that helped carry the people across the Sweetwater River. So in our minds, very likely possible that his great-great-grandfather carried my 14-year-old great-great-grandmother across the Sweetwater River.
That would be a neat connection if it happened that way.
Yeah.
And it's very possible it could have happened.
The other thing is I know that my dad had a love of history, church history, and I wouldn't have known about this and I wouldn't be on this mission if he hadn't taught me about my ancestors. So when the kids come through and the treks come in, and as they learn these things, especially those that have ancestors, I say, now, your job is to go home and teach your siblings, teach your cousins, and as you grow up, you teach your kids, because they need to know it. They need to have roots.
That's also the exact same instruction that President Hinckley gave for all of us members of the church. So that's kind of a neat thing.
Well, Elder Turek, why don't you share one of your stories with us?
Well, I'll share a story with you. This is not necessarily about the rescue or a person here. It'll be about C.A. Huntington. It's a story that took place back in Utah. He was one of the primary interpreters for the church as well as the government when he was in Utah. And there were some, and the reason that I'll tell it here is because this is, bridge is the one that celebrates the four young men and our others who helped carry folks across the Sweetwater, and he was one of those four young men. And so I'll tell this story about him. They were having some Indian trouble, which was not atypical of the time. And it was not atypical for him to be involved in those kind of activities because of his ability to speak the language. And he'd been asked to go and scout a great deal for Brigham Young in other times. So Brigham Young called him in and told him that he had a special mission for him to go on. And he wanted him to go up into the mountains and meet with a tribe of Indians who were pretty hostile. As a part of that, he gave him a blessing and promised him that if he did so, he would be able to return safely. So he went up, went into the Indian village, met with them. They had been in war. There were a number of their people who had been killed in a little skirmish. They wanted to kill him, and they were standing around saying, "Let's kill him, let's kill him, let's kill him." One old Indian there kept saying, "No, let's not kill him." While he was still there, a rider came in and let them know that one of their favorite chiefs had just been killed as well in a skirmish. And the women started to scream, "Let's kill him, we want him dead." And it got pretty fierce, and finally this old gentleman stood up and he said, "Look, one of the things that we of Indians do is we have honor and we honor people who are brave. The man came into our village all by himself to try to talk peace, and whether we want to hear or not, his bravery deserves him being allowed to leave here." And they allowed him to leave there, thus fulfilling Brigham Young's promise.
Oh, that's wonderful. And this was your great-great...
Great-grandfather.
His great-grandfather.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. That story actually is not a family tradition. We did not know about it until we researched it. It actually comes out of somebody else's journal. So that's how we found that one out.
Wow, what a wonderful, wonderful heritage you come from. Both of you.
Thank you. Many of us come from wonderful heritage. Our families just happened to be in the right or wrong place at the right or wrong time so that there's recognition. But think of all the thousands that did the same thing that they did just did not happen to get written up because it wasn't some big famous event. But any person who crossed these plains, I don't care if summer or winter, it was not easy. You had to be incredibly brave to leave your native land, sail the ocean, go to a country you knew nothing about, then go into a wilderness that was very primitive and very few people lived there and they knew nothing about, and try to settle it. All of them had to be brave.
Yeah. And that's tens of thousands of saints who did that.
Yep.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Just a quick question before we move on the trail. What are your thoughts being out here and seeing the sacrifice that these saints made 160 years ago? What are your thoughts about the gospel and the strength of the gospel in their lives and what it means to you in your life?
Well, I guess the thing that that I see that is kind of paramount in this whole thing for me is the notion that with the Martin Company and the Willie Company, but since we're here at Martin's Cove, we'll talk about the Martin Company, something continued to drive them. It was easy to lie down when you have hypothermia. It's easy to lie down and let the weather finish the job for you. It's a fairly simple, easy death compared to continuing to try to go on when your feet are totally frozen, your toes are falling off. It's an easy way to get out of it, but they chose not to do that. Some might say, well, it's just the survival instinct. That's a possibility. But in my head, I choose to think that they left England for a specific reason, and that's to be an eternal family. And that could not happen if they laid down and let nature take its course. And the driving force was that desperate need, that power within them that the gospel would bring of being sealed for eternity, that forced them forward.
Wonderful. Sister Turk, you want to add anything to that?
Even in their darkest hour, even when they were the most desperate, they didn't seem to turn on the gospel. They didn't seem to turn on Heavenly Father. They continued to thank Him. They continued to praise Him. And even in years later, as they thought back on it, and they wrote in their journals and they wrote their words, they continued to praise God. They went forward no matter what their circumstances were, no matter how difficult that was. Most of them went forward, had large families, and raised their children. And the posterity, to me, seems just phenomenal. And the proportion of those that remained strong in the gospel had to start from them, that they taught that to their children and required that. They wanted people to know that what they did for the gospel's sake, because they loved it.
You know, recently we went and saw 17 Miracles as T.C. Christensen's film, and we know that you saw it here at Martin's Cove. When we saw it, and he probably did this here too, he had everybody stand up who had been a descendant of somebody in a handcart company, even from the Martin or Willie handcart companies. And a good, I would say 30 or 40% of the room stood up. And he said he doesn't know why they had to go through the trouble that they did and the struggles. But he does know this, that there were many, many strong saints that came from them. And so just like you said, Sister Turk, a great heritage and a great strength from their dedication that continues. Thanks for your service, and thanks for sharing these stories and sharing them with so many people who come through here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And come again. We'd love to have you come. We love Martin's Cove.
You're listening to Why I Believe on the Mormon channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Join us now as we continue our visit at Martin's Cove, part of the Mormon Handcart Historic Sites of Wyoming.
So we're now walking back about a mile to the Martin Cove Visitor Center, and we've done a river crossing with a handcart, which was quite an experience trying to imagine what the pioneers did to cross that river, and to imagine the wind chill factor and the winter and the ice flow going down the river, and just the broken hearts and the broken spirits that were stopped by the river. They just didn't think they could go on. And the strength of those who helped them cross. So now I just want to hear a few thoughts from my family about some of their thoughts and feelings as we've been experiencing the Martin Cove experience. Teresa, my wife, what were your thoughts as we've been going through all this area?
Well, as we crossed the Sweetwater, I was thinking about a story about my ancestors, Leopold and Anna Werthlin, who left everything in Switzerland and joined one of the companies. And they were engaged. They were waiting to get sealed in Salt Lake City. And as they crossed the Platte River, their wagon tipped over, and they lost everything down the river. And they came into the valley with just the clothes on their backs. So that's what was going through my mind as I crossed the Sweetwater. I thought of them and how grateful I am that they were willing to make that sacrifice so that we and our family can all have the gospel of Jesus Christ in our lives. I'm so thankful for their sacrifice.
Tiffany, you had an interesting experience as we were crossing the river. Your two brothers pulled you, and you were in the handcart. And you were asked to imagine what it would feel like being one of those who was so sick and tired that you couldn't get out of the handcart to help them. And yet you knew that what they were doing was possibly killing them. What were your thoughts about that?
It really was just a very different experience. When they asked me to get in the handcart, I was like, what? I want to help them pull it, you know? But so I got in and just watching them trying to pull it, and it would get stuck in the rocks, and the river was trying to kind of pull the handcart different directions, and I really just wanted to get out and help them, but I couldn't. And I was just thinking about, you know, in real life, those men that helped them cross the rivers were risking their own lives to carry everyone across, and I don't know, it was just really, like, amazing. They had so much faith to do that and to sacrifice so much of themselves for everyone else. It was really overwhelming, I guess.
Tyler, what were your thoughts about the handcart experience out here at Martin Cove?
Well, just when Daniel and me were pulling Tiffany across the river, just kind of thinking while I was doing that about, because we were struggling a little bit, even with a little bit of current and with the mud, the tires were kind of sinking in the mud, or the wheels, and we had to push really hard to make it through, and we were struggling a little bit, and I was thinking how it would be if my feet were freezing, you know.
Hello.
Hi. And just how hard it was just with just Tiffany in there, but how much hard it would be to do that in the freezing water and below zero temperatures. It was just kind of a cool experience to be trying to take care of your family. And
the main reason that the saints from England and from Scotland and Denmark wanted to come to the West was because they wanted to follow Brigham Young's counsel to come to Zion. And they wanted to get to Salt Lake in order to do their temple ordinances. And so when the missionaries approached them in England and gave them this information about the gospel, and they accepted it and were baptized, then they were anxious to travel. The biggest problem was that the last two handcart companies became very, very late in the season. When people joined the church, they were driven out of their homes. They lost their jobs. And so from that point, they needed to come to America because they had no other resources. The problem was that when they got ready to leave, the ships in England were not ready for them. So that delayed them 3 weeks. When they got to the United States and got to Iowa City, then the wagons and the tents were not ready. And so it delayed them. When they reached Independence Rock, they should have been there by the 4th of July in order to ensure that they reached the valley without bad weather. The pioneers for the Martin Company were at Casper, Wyoming area, or Bessemer Bend, on the 19th of October. And so they were that far behind schedule. And then when they finally did get their hand carts, they were given only 17 pounds. We have a box here that shows what 17 pounds looks like. If all you could take with you for the entire trek was a change of clothes and a dish to eat off from, and maybe a book or two, perhaps a blanket or something, but there wasn't very much, because by the time you got five people or a family assigned to a handcart, there wasn't enough room simply to be able to take very much stuff. Plus, they needed to pile bags of flour on top of those clothes in order for people to help carry the food. And then we have a handcart that gives you a replica of what a handcart looks like. And we noticed that the handcart wheels are wrapped with rawhide because the people couldn't afford metal in order to wrap their wheels to protect them. As the saints went along, they eventually got to the point where their hunger was so great that they took the rawhide from the wheels and boiled it in order to make broth. And there were times when they would cut the tongues out of their leather shoes and boil them to make broth so that they had food to eat.
What motivated the church to instigate the handcart program? Well, they tried. There were so many poor people in the European area that wanted to emigrate because they were called to emigrate. They tried the perpetual immigration fund. That went broke because they had poor crops. They couldn't refund what they'd had, and it just went broke. So then Brigham Young says, we'll institute this program, and he designed the handcarts. You can always tell a Brigham Young designed handcart because it only has 10 spokes. And that one has 12, I believe.
Why would there be a difference?
Well, the difference is, of course, you have less strength with 10, but you also have less weight. So the perpetual immigration fund didn't work. The hand carts only cost about $10, $15 to build. If you had a wagon, it was about $300 or $400. So you can see the obvious. The saints in Europe really embraced the program because they could immigrate and still afford it.
Do you know how many people immigrated using hand carts?
There were altogether 10 handcart companies. Five of them were in 1856, and then the next year the other five. The first three were very good successes because they started out on time. Number four and number five are the two we're talking about. That would be the Willie and the Martin handcart companies. They got a very late start, and that was the biggest problem. People didn't even know they were coming. And as soon as Brigham Young found out they were coming, he launched quite a rescue effort to get them back into Salt Lake safely. But the problem they had with the Mount Martin Handcart Company, when they got to Florence, they weren't expected. They had no provisions available. Handcarts weren't built for them. So they ended up building their own handcarts and making their own tents. The handcarts they built were built out of green wood. They didn't last very long. So they took whatever they could to try to get going, and they were determined to heed the call and go to Zion. Many of these handcarts were just left to rot right here on this ranch, because as soon as they left Martin's Cove, they didn't need them anymore. They left them here. I think Mom told you about the hub-and-spoke brand.
For the Sun family.
Yeah, the reason why it was hub and spoke is because so many of these were found on the ranch. And they ended up burning most of them. The Martin Handcart Company, as many as could get on the wagons, you know, whatever was available, they didn't walk anymore. When they got to South Pass, they were met by more wagons from Salt Lake City. And because of that, they were all able to ride from there on into Salt Lake, about 230 miles.
All right, Sister Star, tell us about the Sun Ranch and how that relates to Martin's Cove.
In 1872, Tom Sun came to this area and he homesteaded a lot of the ranch. He was a guide to some very wealthy people that came from England and from the East Coast, and so he was able to save enough money to go and purchase 4,000 head of cattle, and he brought them back here to the ranch and established an empire. It was about a little over 1 million acres, and it went from all the way up above Devil's Gate down almost to Rawlins, Wyoming. The Mormon Trail ran right through the middle of his property. And the reason it did is because the Sweetwater River also runs through the property, and that's the route that the pioneers took, was to stay close to that river. He homesteaded close to the Devil's Gate area, and here in the visitor center at Martin's Cove, we still have original buildings to the Sun family. The visitor center started out with one building, and as the family grew, they would bring in bunkhouses off the ranch and add them to the home. So from the outside, it looks like a motel because there's so many doors, but it's because they added to it so many times. And then when they got to this room, which we call the Sun Room, it's in honor of the Sun family. And the original buildings that we have here are the barn, which the missionaries still use, and the blacksmith shop. That's another original building. And so Tom's son then left his ranch to his family, and Tom Sun Jr. and his wife Nellie took over this property, and this room was the last room that was added on, and it has the fireplace. Nellie Sun was a rock collector, and she collected rocks from off the property. There are grinding stones from the Indians. There's petrified wood, and it's rumored that she sat right in this room and instructed the people how to build her fireplace. The original brand for the Sun Ranch was Three Dots, but because they found so many broken hubs and wheels on the property from the handcart pioneers, they changed their brand to the Hub and Spoke, and that's what this room represents, some of the memorabilia from the Sun family.
You've been listening to Episode 2 of a series on the Mormon Handcart Historic Sites of Wyoming. Please join us for Episode 3 of this four-part series to hear from Elder and Sister Fenn, directors of these sites. They'll share their connection to the handcart pioneers and how up to 70 missionary couples work to keep this facility open year-round. You can download and listen to this and other episodes of Why I Believe by visiting mormonchannel.org/programs. Scroll down and select Why I Believe. Thanks for listening.